And welcome back to Coast. Up next, Mark Hartzman joins us. He's back after about a five-year hiatus. His new work is called The Big Book of Mars. We're going to talk about that and some of his past works that he's done. And we're talking bizarre tonight, folks. And I mean bizarre. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Mark Hartzman with us. His latest book is called The Big Book of Mars, From Ancient Egypt to the Martian. A deep dive into our obsession with the red planet. He's also written a number of other books, including American Sideshow, an encyclopedia of history's most wondrous and curiously strange performers, found on eBay, 101 genuinely bizarre items from the world's online yard sale. He's been a contributor to the Weird News section of AOL and the Huffington Post, maintaining a career as an award-winning group creative director at a New York advertising agency. Mark Hartzman back on Coast to Coast. Been a long time, Mark. Welcome back.
Thanks, George. It's good to be back.
And you're staying up late on the East Coast for us. I appreciate it.
No problem.
How are things in the advertising world? Are you sensing things picking up a little bit, or are they still kind of on hold?
Still kind of on hold. Still a little bleak, but hopefully not for too much longer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I want to talk about some of your other books for people who might not remember you from 5 years ago. You are as bizarre as Robert Ripley. And that take that as a compliment, by the way.
I do, absolutely.
What got you into the weird and unusual?
I've loved it just really since I was a kid. I used to watch Ripley's Believe It or Not, actually, all the time when I was a kid. And I used to love buying the Guinness Book of World Records when it was just sort of the small, thick paperback book.
Yep.
Black and white. And I just read that first section with the human oddities. And I was just incredibly fascinated by Robert Wadlow. And every year there'd be like some different pictures, you know, you didn't have the internet or anything like that to go look up stuff. So I check out the new images of Robert Wadlow, and I was just so fascinated by this man who grew to be 8 feet 11 and a half inches tall. And, you know, I'd see him at my age at that time when he was 10 years old, and he'd be 7 feet tall or whatever it was. And I just thought it was incredible. And so I always loved how the human body could just be so unique and different, and people could thrive in all different kinds of ways. So that just kind of got me into the world of sideshow and seeing what people could do with all kinds of different human anomalies.
Absolutely. When I was in my early days of television news in Detroit, my nickname, Mark, was Captain Bizarre, because I had all these weird stories that I'd look for and put on our newscasts, and that's what they gave me. They coined the phrase, here's Captain Bizarre. And
that's great.
I had that moniker for years and years and years, and a lot of the things that you have done are somewhat strange and bizarre, but they're fascinating, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely think they're just incredible stories.
The one that was really strange and bizarre was the book called The Embalmed Head of Oliver Cromwell. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was a story I came across. I was actually looking to do a book about adventures posthumous adventures of body parts. So just different kinds of body parts that lived on, like Galileo's fingers, you know, what happened with those, and they're on display now in Florence, Italy. And as I was researching and jotting down notes, I came across Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head. And the story was just so remarkable that I scratched the whole other idea, and I decided to write the memoirs of this head. And so basically, in a nutshell, what happened was Oliver Cromwell, who was the Lord Protector of England, Ireland, and Scotland in the mid-1600s, during the English Civil War, he led the charge to have Charles I beheaded, took over, so he ended the monarchy. And then when he died in the mid-1600s, he was embalmed and he was buried in Westminster Abbey. He was then exhumed a few years later when Charles II restored the monarchy, and he was pissed off about his dad getting beheaded. So he exhumed the body, he hanged him and beheaded him and stuck this embalmed head atop of Westminster Hall, and it sat there for 25 years, you know, on this wooden pike, you know, with a iron tip going through his skull. And it finally broke off in a storm one night, and it fell to the ground, and a guard picked it up and took it home. And from there, it just kind of got passed around for the next 275 years. So the head basically traveled around England, this embalmed head, for 300 years until it was reburied in 1960. So the book tells the story of those travels from the head's perspective.
Interesting take on it. Of all the stories you've looked at for all your books, and how many books do you have out now, Mark?
Six.
And that includes The Big Book of Mars?
Correct.
Of all the stories you've got out there that you've had over the years, which one would you say is one of the most bizarre?
Well, the Cromwell head story is definitely up there.
That's a strange one. That's right.
And the other one that I really love is the one that got me started on Mars, which was about a guy in the 1920s. He was a London lawyer, and he was in telepathic communication, so we said, with a Martian woman named Uhuru. And when I stumbled across this story, I got so fascinated. And I really wasn't like a space guy or a Mars guy. Not that I didn't like it, but it just wasn't really something I spent much time with.
Right.
But when I came across this story, I got so fascinated and I dug into it. And along the way, I kind of learned all these other stories going on. And that's what kind of led to the book.
That's fast. Now, tell me about this Martian woman. I mean, was this, did he actually believe he was in communications with somebody like that?
Yes. So this was about 1926, maybe a little bit earlier when he started, and he believed he was telepathically communicating with this woman. Her name was Uhuru, and she was about 7 feet tall. She had big ears, tall hair, kind of like Marge Simpson. There's a sketch of her.
Yeah.
This is how I know this, or at least, you know, so he says, right? And she described Mars in quite a bit of detail for him, saying how peaceful it was there, and that they did a lot of things like we did here. They have houses, they drove vehicles, they smoked pipes and drank tea, but they were very peaceful people, and they were more advanced. And the men were much taller. They were maybe 7 to 8, maybe 9 feet tall. And so she was communicating with him, and then he wanted to try to reach the Martians with a radio tower, with a telegram. So at that time, the largest radio tower in the world, the most powerful, was in London. It was called the Rugby Radio Tower, and it ran through the post office. And so he decided he would send a telegram to Mars when it was in opposition, meaning that when Mars was closest
right.
to Earth in its orbit. So that would be about 35 million miles away. So we thought, okay, that's a distance maybe we can reach them with our wavelengths and get a communication in at some kind of timely manner. So he arranged it, and he got the long-distance rate from the post office, which I thought was kind of funny. I think the post office, I have memos in the book from the post office talking about this guy, and like, he seems perfectly sane.
Well, this guy was, he was some kind of doctor, wasn't he?
Yeah. So, but he strongly believed in this. So the post office was okay with it. They didn't think he was a crazy man or anything. They thought that he truly believed this, and it was his study, and it was also a way for them to promote their long-distance rates, which was kind of, I thought, amusing for them.
Yeah.
So they sent out this telegram late one night in 1926, and this was reported in all these newspapers around the world. You know, like New York Times was covering this story. It wasn't just some weird one-off type of thing. This was big news. And, of course, you know, they didn't hear anything back. And he heard from Uhuru telepathically that, you know, they were scientists were up there waiting. You know, they were waiting for their message, and they didn't get it, and they were laughing at our own scientists, thinking that we just didn't have enough smarts to send a proper wavelength, and we were behind. And so he was upset by that. So we tried again 2 years later when Mars was once again in opposition, and still he had no luck. So again, he was disappointed. And Uhuru told him, like, just go to sleep and don't worry about it. We'll keep telepathically talking to each other. And his wife, in the meantime, was annoyed by the whole thing. She's like, I don't know who this woman is, and I'm sick of hearing it. And I won't have
yeah, enough of having this person come in our room at night, right?
Yeah. So the whole thing is just completely shocking to me as I'm reading all these articles and finding out this story. And by the way, a few years after that, Uhuru had him open a college of telepathy because she thought telepathy would solve all of our problems. One of those problems being that the telephones weren't so great back then, so you wouldn't get busy signals
right.
and operators having to deal with stuff. So it would really clear up a lot of issues. That didn't work out too well either. But along the way, so as I'm learning about that and finding how this is also surprising to me that this could be major news, and why, you know, why would he believe this to be true, and why would anyone else believe this to be a possibility? But as I'm studying this and learning more, I'm finding out how many other scientists and legitimate scientists, big names, Harvard professors, you know, heads of astronomy at various universities, and of course, you know, the smartest people on Earth, Tesla, Marconi, have a strong belief in intelligent life on Mars, and we're trying to reach Mars. So for this guy to have thought that maybe he had a way, maybe it wasn't quite as strange in context of what was going on at the time.
That's amazing. But you're right. A lot of people thought that there were things happening on Mars. I think a lot of the frenzy started when Percival Lowell thinks that he found those canals on Mars, right?
Yeah, so Lowell was, he was a big proponent of it. He lectured and he wrote tons of articles and wrote books on it. And so what happened with him was he got the idea from Giovanni Schiaparelli, an Italian astronomer,
right,
who found these lines, a whole network of lines on Mars through his telescope in 1877. And he called them canali, which really translated to channels, which could just be a natural occurrence. But it got mistranslated to canals, which was a whole different story, because canals are artificially made. And at the time, roughly around that time, we had just finished the Suez Canal, which took about 10 years to build. And that was a major engineering feat. So scientists are looking at this whole planet covered in canals, and they're thinking, oh my God, it took us 10 years to build the Suez Canal with our greatest engineering, feats. And here you have a whole planet covered in them. These guys must be...
They're all over the place, yeah.
Huge, strong, So they were kind of blown away by all this. And so Percival Lowell, he had always been into astronomy. And, he came from a very wealthy family. He ran a textile business. So he was sort of, expected to take over that business for the family. But he wasn't interested. So he had gone away, did some studying in Asia, learned about, Asian culture and got sort of involved in that. And when he came back in the early 1890s, Schiaparelli was starting to go blind. He wasn't going to be able to continue his studies. And so Lowell thinks, well, here's a chance for me to sort of have Schiaparelli pass the torch to me. I can make my name as a Lowell, not by textiles, but by talking to Martians. I can be the guy who does that. Or finds them or makes that first contact with Martians. So he's got the money to do it, and he's got the desire to do it. So he moves out from his home in Massachusetts to Arizona, to Flagstaff, Arizona, where he was sent scouts out to find the perfect location. And there he found a mountain where he could build an observatory about 7,000 feet in elevation, which would be completely away from any city lights, anything like that, any interference, to make his observations a lot cleaner and more visible. So he was able to do that and built out his observatory in 1894. And from there, he just started sketching all the canals, tons of sketches of the canals and the various lines and how they were changing over time or coming back through different seasons. And like I said, lecturing about this and theorizing about what was going on. And his main theory was that the planet, because it was an older planet, he believed it was so far advanced that it was now a dying planet. And so the canals were trying to distribute water from the polar caps all across the planet to help save these Martians.
And clearly, you could see these canals in that era with telescopes, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could see these lines on Mars, but it's really later they figured out that this was really just an optical illusion. Anything you look at so far away, can become a straight line, even though it might not really be a straight line.
I think it was liquid water. I think liquid water was flowing on Mars, and they just never knew it.
Well, we'll find that soon, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool. Well, so as you keyed in on the, and by the way, you're not kidding, this is a big book. It weighs about 40 pounds, doesn't it?
There's a lot of information.
How long did it take you to do?
I spent, I guess, about a year researching, writing.
That's not bad. That's not bad, but it's pretty intense once you got into it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, especially, talking with various scientists at NASA and hearing all their plans and challenges was really quite fascinating.
Tell me about the Orson Welles broadcast in 1938, because you think something else happened afterwards.
Yeah, well, so a few things with that. So one is, that's a story that I always knew about. And I think most people are pretty much aware that that's the thing that happened in America, the panic with everybody believing that Martians were really invading Earth when Orson Welles did his War of the Worlds broadcast on October 30th.
And they apparently, these people missed the disclaimer at the top of the show, right?
Yeah, they tuned in late. I think most people were probably listening to Charlie McCarthy, the ventriloquist, or the ventriloquism dummy, I should say, and Edgar Bergen, his ventriloquist. And I'm so fascinated.
That's pretty good act to be able to do that on the radio as a ventriloquist.
I was just going to say that. I love that a ventriloquist could be a hit on radio. I mean, I don't know how that worked, but good for him.
Absolutely.
So yeah, like you said, people tuned in late and they missed it. And Orson Welles, you know, such a genius with the way he put it together and repackaged the H.G. Wells novel to play into America and to work with the medium by having all these interruptions, these news alerts during a orchestra broadcast. You know, that he.
That's sang. Right.
Yeah. So I mean, it's beautifully crafted, and you know, radio's still fairly new. You also have World War II brewing over in Europe.
That's
so
right. And it's believable to people.
Yes, all these breakthroughs are, first of all, aren't surprising because there were emergency breakthroughs happening. And then everything we were just chatting about with these headlines about intelligent life on Mars, you know, Tesla, Marconi, Uemuruu, you know, all these different stories floating around for decades. And so people probably weren't that shocked to hear that maybe something was finally happening, you know, having missed the disclaimer. And not being familiar enough with the H.G. Wells novel, apparently, either. So they panicked. So to me, it was very interesting to sort of get a better sense of the context of what was going on at that time to see why people may have, you know, fled their homes and, you know, ran for their lives and, you know, volunteered to help the police fight the Martians and whatever they could do. So,
and some jumped off buildings and stuff, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, people did all kinds of really crazy things. It was a true panic. So what's really amazing to me is, you know, you would think that after that happened and everyone got clarified on what happened, you know, like, oh, this was just a radio show. And by the way, Orson Welles made the announcement a few times throughout, but they just kept missing it or they were too busy running for their lives to hear
exactly.
A later announcement. So you would think that something like that wouldn't happen again because that was pretty crazy. And I think the FCC put some laws in place too about like not trying to fake radio broadcasts or anything like that anymore. But it happened again 11 years later, which I found really surprising, in Quito, Ecuador. So this was a small town in Ecuador, and a couple radio DJs decided they needed to drum up some publicity or attention for their station. So they thought, hey, we should do that War of the Worlds thing.
So they did it all over again?
So they did it again. And they did it, so first of all, they didn't at least have the courtesy that Welles did to say it was a dramatization. They just did it.
Oh.
And like Welles, they made it local. So now it was the Martians were attacking a nearby village, and they had people impersonating, like, the local mayor, you know, priests. So they had all these characters playing like locals, you know, freaking out,
Wow. Terrified.
And so people, again, they panicked. They thought it was real. The police were rushing out to this village. I forgot the name of the village, but they were rushing out to the village where the Martians were supposedly attacking to help. So they were gone. And then once people found out, I think they finally announced, like, hey, by the way, you know, this isn't real. And so once people found out, they got so angry. And so they banded together as a mob, and they rioted at the radio station.
Oh, they attacked them. Oh, my
God. They
attacked
them, and they started, like, throwing fire. And they set the station on fire, and because it was such a huge crowd, the fire department couldn't get there. They couldn't get through the crowd in time.
Oh.
15 people ended up dying.
15? What happened to those DJs?
I think one of them ended up fleeing the country, and I think the other went to prison, if I remember correctly.
Oh, my. Yeah, their career. Those were career enders for them, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, stay with us, Mark. We're going to take a break, then we'll come back and talk more about the Big Book of Mars, why we're so fascinated with the red planet. Let's go back to the Egyptian era, too, and apparently they were interested. And Cairo means Mars, by the way, in Arabic, so that's fascinating, too. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Mark Hartzman with us, and his latest book is called The Big Book of Mars. Let's talk a little bit about ancient Egypt and its fascination with Mars, Mark.
Sure. Well, you know, the interest in Mars goes all the way back, obviously, to the ancient Egyptians when they were out there staring at the sky and seeing these stars. And, of course, there's one of them is this glowing red dot out there. And so they're wondering, you know, what is this place? And because of the red color, they associate it with bloodshed, obviously instead of what it actually is, which is just the oxidized iron dust all over the surface. So they named it Har Desher, which meant the red one. And other civilizations, as time went on, they had the same sort of notion that here's this red dot associated with bloodshed or war or the god of their god of war, and named it appropriately based on you know, whatever their language was, whether it was the Hebrews calling it Adam, the Babylonians called it Nergal, after their god of war and destruction. So this was a theme that just continued on until it landed on the name Mars, which obviously stuck as the Roman god of war.
That's fascinating. It really is. How did you find all these little tidbits and strange stories? Just research?
Yeah, a lot of research. A lot of it comes from, obviously, from old books, from old newspaper archives that are just a wealth of information, finding these sort of odd and obscure stories and piecing them together. And, you know, one thing leads you to another thing, and you kind of dig into it and chase down these various stories. So that's where a lot of the stranger ones come from. And then obviously just talking to other people too. And you learn one thing and you lead into that, and then you find more things that kind of spin off of that story as well. And it all just sort of comes together.
Who was Pierre Guzman?
So Pierre Guzman was the son of Madame Guzman, and she was a French woman who in 1891 bequeathed 100,000 francs to the French Academy of Sciences. And this was to be given to any scientist or any person, no matter what nationality, who could make contact with another planet, with another species. And she named this prize after her son, who was a budding astronomer and just loved the stars, so she wanted it to be named after him. The one catch with this prize was if you were going to make contact with another species out there, another sort of form of extraterrestrial life, it had to be any place but Mars. And the reason for that is because she thought Mars would be too easy.
Huh. Now, also, though, during the late 19th century, a lot of spiritualists felt that they were in touch with Martian spirits, didn't they?
Yeah. So spiritualism was, you know, really growing in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And not only were they talking to spirits of lost loved ones from Earth, but they were talking to spirits on Mars. They were visiting Mars. Some of these people were having, you know, they would write a book and say that their spirit went to Mars and visited there, and they would describe the entire Martian civilization in great detail. And oftentimes what they said, what these very spiritualists, were that the Martians were very religious, and they were very much into God and understood his role in the universe, and they were very peaceful. Everything was wonderful there. It was almost like Mars was a utopia. And I think they were doing that almost to preach back to people on Earth that, hey, if we follow God and we follow our religion, then we too can have peace like the Martians do. So you had some spiritualists that were kind of taking that route. Others were just describing what life was like and finding spirits of their own lost loved ones living on Mars now. And they had homes built by the canals. They had their various flying vehicles, some of them dressed in baggy clothes, which was kind of funny. There's sketches of them. And some of them even wrote in Martian. They had claimed that they could speak Martian and they could write in Martian. There's examples of that in the book. And they were this particular person name was Helene Smith. She was studied by a psychologist who eventually determined that she had multiple personality disorder and was just sort of mashing a bunch of languages together to come up with this stuff. But it's pretty fascinating to hear their tales and how, to what degree people believe them for a while, that maybe they were talking to spirits on Mars and maybe this is what Mars is like. They had their opinions and they had, you know, no need to reach them scientifically. They could just fly there and see them themselves.
Hold on for a second, Mark. We have a breaking story. There is a tsunami warning for the southern part of Alaska. Tommy, what do we have here?
Yeah, George, this is a magnitude 7.8. It struck off the coast of Alaska early Wednesday morning. That's a big one. The earthquake was centered 60 miles south-southeast of Perryville, Alaska. And I want to point out that this is a tsunami warning has been issued. So we'll let you know more as we get more in here, but it is a 7.8 off the coast of Alaska.
Okay, be careful out there, folks, those of you on the southern part of Alaska, and just head for high ground if you can, especially if you're on those coastlines. And a 7.8, as Tom just pointed out, is a huge earthquake. Mark, back to you. Of course, the news never stops, Mr. Hartsman, does it?
No, never does.
this fascination with Mars continues to this day with all of us, doesn't it? Why? Why are we so fascinated with that planet?
Well, I think there's part of it is just the unknown, and it's our closest neighbor. So if we're ever going to go somewhere beyond the moon, Mars is it, which is pretty fascinating. And the fact that, you know, we've been able to get robots there, you know, Mars is populated by robots right now, and we're learning all these different facts about it. I mean, Mars is in the news all the time now, which has really been pretty amazing. But there's a lot to be fascinated by. I mean, there's still this question of, you know, where did life come from? Is there other life out there? I mean, these are questions people have been asking forever, right? And so could we find something still on Mars? I mean, clearly we don't have the 7-foot Martians with the big ears like Uluru. We've established that pretty well. But there could still be something lurking, you know, well under the surface. And, you know, there's reports that they found water well beneath the surface or ice.
Yep.
And where there's water, you have the ingredients for life. The various rovers that have been there that NASA has sent, they have found signs of water being there, you know, thousands of years ago, millions of years ago. So, again, that leads them to believe that life could have existed at that time. Again, the ingredients were there. Whether life took advantage of it or not is still unknown. But they're hoping that they can still find evidence of past life as they continue the search and potentially, you know, present life. So it's definitely a fascinating question as to what's there. And then, of course, there's the question of can we ever put humans there? And there's a lot of challenges involved with that, but that's being worked on now as well. And it's kind of exciting to see where that goes.
Did you see the movie The Martian with Matt Damon?
Yeah, I loved it.
That's in your book. You've highlighted that. That's a great movie and pretty realistic, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, Andy Weir was, you know, he's a pretty brilliant guy, and he has a lot of real science in there. He did a lot of his own calculations to figure out various trajectories and so forth in terms of how he would get there and the time it would take and how things would actually work. So he put a lot of real science into his story. It's pretty amazing.
You have uncovered that our rocketry program in NASA's JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was created by a Satanist. Where did you find that story?
So that was something that first, you know, I mentioned that sometimes people just tell you something that you have to go sort of chase down. So a guy I met who was working at NASA JPL just kind of mentioned it in a comment to me. They're like, oh, well, you know, that's started by a Satanist and a cultist. So I looked into that. And it was a guy named Jack Parsons. And Jack Parsons is kind of responsible for the American rocketry program. This was a guy who just had started when he was like in his teenage years, in the 20s, when he was just fascinated by stories like Jules Verne and reading amazing stories, you know, the magazine at that time, and really got into this idea of leaving Earth, you know, making Jules Verne stories real. At the same time, he was also exploring black magic and trying to summon Satan in his bedroom, which didn't work, but he kind of freaked himself out. So he got together with a friend of his, and they were out in California, and they would go out to the desert, and they would start experimenting with chemicals and trying to create some kind of rockets and see what could happen. And they were following a little bit of what Robert Goddard had been doing, and he kind of helped kick off rocketry in the early 1900s, but never really went anywhere with it. He had some minor success, but didn't really continue to pursue it. So Jack Parsons sort of picked up where he left off. And they got together with another friend who was a Caltech because they needed some more materials. And together, the three of them got some backing by one of the professors at Caltech to continue trying to develop a rocket. And everyone kind of thought they were a little bit crazy because, you know, here's these major explosives. So they became known as the Suicide Squad. So as this was going on, you know, they're starting to develop more and more. And they're making progress with these rockets. And in the meantime, Parsons is continuing his interest in the occult. And so they join a local group called the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. And that was headed in London by Aleister Crowley.
Oh, geez.
Who, was considered himself the great beast 666. You know, was considered the wickedest man in the world by the English press. And so he was leading up the local version of this cult out in California. And they're just having all kinds of crazy parties, you know, during the 30s, sex parties, drugs, music, naked pregnant women running around dancing outside. I mean, it's just full of craziness, and then back to rockets, and then back to craziness. and then he'd be testing rockets with government officials, and he'd be dancing and chanting, you know, Crowley hymns and that kind of thing while, you know, testing rockets. And the government officials just thought he was kind of wacky. You know, that's all. They weren't too concerned about his devilish endeavors. At some point, he got together with L. Ron Hubbard,
sure,
who joined the cult, and he got really excited by L. Ron Hubbard and tried to, you know, tell Aleister Crowley how great this guy would be and what a prized recruit he was to the cult. And Crowley thought he was maybe just a bit of a charlatan. So together, Hubbard and Parsons tried to impregnate a woman to bring about the Antichrist. So,
unbelievable.
Yeah, so all this crazy stuff. L. Ron Hubbard actually ends up leaving with this woman and stealing all Parsons' money, leaving him kind of broke, and things kind of go downhill for Parsons from there. But in the meantime, the rocketry program was picking up. It was getting more backing. The government was interested in it, realizing they needed this as World War II was, again, you know, brewing and coming into place. And from there, you know, we have rockets. And from there, we're able to eventually get the first spacecraft to Mars in the 60s, put the first man in space, of course. And so we have a rocket program from that. So it's pretty fascinating to see that, you know, behind Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which he helped establish, he was practicing the occult.
You have a book called The Big Book of Mars available for folks. How do they find it?
Anywhere you buy books. Right now, you know, probably a little bit easier to buy online. If you can get to a bookstore, it's there. But Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, or you can go to quirkbooks.com, and they have a whole listing of places you can purchase the book.
One of the books that you had, and I think we may have talked about it back in 2015, was The American Sideshow, right?
Yes.
That was, tell us about that. That had to do with strange people, didn't it?
Yeah, so that was filled with just different sideshow performers from about the mid-1800s to present day, which was, you know, early 2000s at that time. So yeah, it covers all kinds of amazing stories of various human oddities, you know, from giants and little people to legless people, armless people, conjoined twins, and so on. So yeah, it's pretty comprehensive look at various sideshow performers and the lives they led and the successes that they had and the challenges that they overcame.
Were a lot of these people, Mark, solicited for the circus?
Some of them were, yeah, were asked to join, and some of them went to, you know, there were cases where people went to P.T. Barnum and said, hey, I want to join your show. You know, Charles Tripp, an armless man, traveled from Canada to New York, marched into P.T. Barnum's office, showed him how he could write with his toes and cut things with his toes and, you know, carve wood with his feet, and got hired on the spot. So it kind of worked a little bit both ways.
How many of these were birth deformities?
In terms of the book, I'd say the majority were birth deformities, except when I got into the more modern era, then you have more of the working acts, which would be the sword swallowers, the fire eaters, the human blockheads, and other various stunts. But for the most part, you know, it was people who were born different and were able to make livings and have families and, you know, find a way to be self-sufficient in life at a time when, you know, you didn't have many other opportunities.
Well, what's interesting, they didn't have television, they didn't have radio, they didn't have video games, they didn't have smartphones. So this was also the entertainment of the era, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when the sideshow and the circus came to town, that was the entertainment. That was the thing to go see, and you weren't going to see it anywhere else. And these, you know, the freaks who were performing, they were the stars of the stage, and they made great money. I mean, Tom Thumb was making $1 million in the mid-1800s.
Wow.
The money was really good for a lot of these performers during its heyday. And so, again, you know, they could travel the world. You know, they could meet with royalty. They could go places they would have never gone otherwise. I mean, if they didn't have this outlet, they likely would have, you know, been kept at home, kept away from people. People may have been ashamed to have them seen. They could have been institutionalized. So here was a way for them to have a life. You know, if they were out, people were going to stare at them no matter what because, you know, we're all curious and we see something different and we look. Here was a way for them to make money while that was happening and perform and be amongst other people that had similar conditions, you know, whether it was whatever it was. There was a camaraderie ship that they were with other people that were different. And I think for a lot of them that helped and you know, they forged friendships and found love and all kinds of amazing stories. I mean, one of my favorite stories is the guy who's on the cover, whose name is Johnny Yek, and he was a half man. He had no legs, and he had a twin brother who's full size, and you see them both on the cover. And Johnny Yek, just this man let nothing stop him. You know, he had no legs, but he lived such a full life. I mean, outside of Sideshow, he did all kinds of other things. He was an artist. You know, he ran a small train ride that people could, you know, pay money to go ride on. He just kind of did whatever he wanted to do. And I love that.
And he made his life work, didn't he?
He absolutely did, yeah. I mean, my favorite story about him in terms of the Sideshow is a stunt that he pulled off with his twin brother. So, again, the twin brother was full size. He had his legs. And they did this trick with a magician where the magician would call the volunteer, and it would be the twin brother who would walk up on stage, and it was the old saw the person half trick.
So the
that's would get into the box.
Bizarre but funny. My gosh.
So the magician
hold on, Mark. We'll come back and talk more. Also want to talk about your book called God Made Me Do It, and we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.